Welcome back. I'm Max Bergman, director of the Stuart Center and Europe-Russia-Eurasia program at CSIS.
And I'm Maria Snigovaya, senior fellow for Russia and Eurasia.
And you're listening to Russian Roulette, a podcast discussing all things Russia and Eurasia from the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Russian Roulette. I'm your host, Maria Snigovaya, and today I'm flying solo while Max is out. Joining us today on the show is Dr. Nikolai Petrov, an independent researcher focused on Russian domestic politics and its impact on foreign policy, Russian political regime, and on Russian elites. Since February 2023, Nikolai has been a non-resident guest scholar at SWP, the German Institute for International Security Affairs. Thank you very much, Nikolai, for finding time to join us today.
My pleasure.
Also joining me is Dr. Liana Fix. Liana is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, specializing in German and European foreign and security policy, Russian and Eastern Europe, and European policy towards China. She's also an adjunct faculty member at Georgetown University. And Liana, thank you very much for joining me as well today.
Thanks so much for the invitation, Maria.
Today, the three of us will be discussing the current situation in Russian domestic politics, specifically in the run-up to the Russian presidential election later this month. And there are a lot of unusual things about these presidential elections. For example, this presidential election, unlike the previous ones, is going to last for 3 days, from Friday, March 15th, all the way to Sunday, March 17th. It's also the first time that Russia is trying a remote electronic voting system in Russia's presidential election. Probably, I'm going to venture this, allowing a lot of possibilities for falsification in what is already quite suspicious election in terms of electoral freedom and fairness. So having said that, perhaps Nikola, let me start with you. Any intrigue there at all? Why shall we even bother discussing this presidential election? Are we not all quite aware of what the outcome is going to be? What shall we be looking for?
Well, first of all, I would say that it's not the case. We do think that in authoritarian system, it's easy to manage to steal elections. Let's look at, for example, Lukashenko example in 2020 to understand that there are serious problems for any authoritarian leader in elections. There are very serious problems for Putin, especially because he needs to jump higher than he did already jump in 4 previous attempts. And it's not that easy being 71-year-old. Although Putin was capable to choose his opponents, it's himself, first of all, who is his major competitor. Because if to compare him now with how he looked and how he did act 20 years ago, well, his present-day image doesn't look that impressive. So first of all, Putin and thus the Kremlin need to demonstrate that Putin's support now is higher than ever. That's why they need to get to report about 60 million votes, which is not that easy, having in mind that they did already use all possibilities last time, 6 years ago, in order to demonstrate impressive result. But you are right that, first of all, there is electronic voting. And second, there are annexed regions. And annexed regions, according to preliminary reports, they can give up to 5 million votes, which is a huge number, and nobody can observe elections. And that is important because first thing is to report about very impressive results. But the second thing is to avoid any serious public scandals and any doubts in these results. And what is tricky, it's that it's important to demonstrate this not to the West, which is not that complicated, but not that important, not even to Russians, but it's needed to demonstrate this to Russian political elites. But it's not that easy to report about huge results without any real grounds, because elites do watch elections from within, And in case Putin is not capable to demonstrate high result, then the stability of the whole system is under the question.
Many thanks, Nikolai. I loved your point about Putin competing against himself, first and foremost. And do we get a sense? I don't think we're allowed to gamble, but I'm just curious as to, like, what is the potential target number that Putin is going for? I'm looking right now at the result of 2018 Russian presidential election 6 years ago with a turnout of 67%, 67.5%, and Putin getting 77% of votes, almost 78%. Like, how much higher can he jump?
Well, first of all, they do think in terms of absolute numbers, like 60 million votes in favor of Putin, which means that, well, they need approximately to report about 80% turnout and 80% in favor of Putin. But the trick is that those figures are important not only at the national level, but at regional levels as well. So they should report about impressive results for Moscow and St. Petersburg, which is perhaps the most tricky thing for them.
So also not just high numbers, but also demonstrating those high numbers is potentially in the biggest cities where support for Putin is more fragile, let us put it this way. Liana, perhaps to you, do you agree with Nikolai? Anything else we should be looking at? And Nikolai pointed out that perhaps the trying to make an impression on the international community is less of a concern for Putin in this time around. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, perhaps just to add one or two points. Obviously, it's not the primary audience, but of course, the elections do have an impression on the international scene. And it's pretty clear that in the West, no one accepts these elections as really legitimate, right? I mean, it's pretty clear that those are falsified, and that those elections are basically held to give some kind of veneer of legitimacy to Vladimir Putin and his popularity at home. But there are constituencies in the West that use these elections to continue the myth that Vladimir Putin, even though the elections might be a little bit rigged, Vladimir Putin is still the only alternative in Russia. They continue to advance these kinds of myths that Russia has always been an autocratic system and that there's no alternative to that. Mostly constituencies who are more on the further left or further right side, who are more Russia-friendly than most constituencies in the mainstream parties in Western countries. And this election helps them to advance these kinds of myths. Obviously, as I said, again, in the Western general assumption, these elections are not taken seriously, but we do still see that people are referring to Putin as President Putin, right? I mean, it could be one step to say, I mean, after so many years and such clear evidence about rigged elections, not to speak about President Putin anymore, but just to speak about Vladimir Putin. So there could be steps from the West taken to make clearer how these elections are viewed. And again, for those who want to believe that Russia is an autocratic society, that Putin may not be a great choice, but he's still very popular and there's no alternative to him, and that Alexei Navalny never was a real alternative. And even if Vladimir Putin would not suppress the opposition in his society, there would no alternative would come up to him. That still gives some kind of food for this kind of thinking, which then leads to suggestions that in the end, we have to get along with Putin. We have to find a deal over Ukraine because he will stay where he is. And to some extent, he is legitimate where he is. And therefore, we have to get along and to find a deal with him over Ukraine. And that is sort of the line of thinking where the elections and the rigged and sort of the outcome of the elections does influence some constituencies in the West who have been more Russia-friendly than others.
Thank you, Lena. On that note, though, there's a lot of discussion among the international observers these days that given everything that's happening in Russia, outside of Russia, given everything surrounding this election, the fact that they're lasting now for 3 days, making it absolutely impossible to monitor them along with this so-called electronic voting, remote voting. Putin is hardly a legitimate leader. Having said that, what is your sense? Do you think this election in Russia will be eventually recognized as being legitimate as a result of this dynamic, given that, as we have discussed, the outcome of this election is hardly a huge puzzle, a huge surprise, right?
One advantage Vladimir Putin has in this election is that he's holding elections, and he can argue that he's holding elections while Ukraine is not holding elections. And that is an argument that is, again, not popular among sort of the central or the center, but it's popular among the further left and the further right, among those who are skeptical of Ukraine, among the global south, right? So it's not only the West that looks at these elections. And so with this election, he can show, well, at least even if those are rigged, I'm holding elections, whereas Ukraine is not. And that's a cheap argument. It's very clear that Ukraine cannot hold elections in a situation where they are under martial law, where their territory is occupied, where so many Ukrainian refugees are abroad and not able to vote, where there would be oppression for any vote, if possible at all, probably impossible under Russian-occupied territory. So it is an absolutely legitimate claim to make to argue that Russia is more democratic than Ukraine at the moment. But with some constituencies, this does resonate, and this feeds to a kind of suspicion and skepticism towards Ukraine and towards Ukraine's democracy that Russian propaganda can easily exploit.
We can certainly envision Tucker Carlson making this
exactly
point in his notable interview.
Exactly.
But more broadly, though, is there a chance that the international community, the Western international community, will not recognize Putin as legitimate ruler of Russia as a result of this election?
I would say it's time to do that. After so many years, it's pretty obvious. But as I said, for many Western countries, they're still referring to President Vladimir Putin because they consider that even if it's rigged, the opinion polls, he's still popular. So it might be not that far off, perhaps.
And frankly, I'll add to that, there's also this issue of, you know, the strategic stability, climate change, all the other issues on which we just need somebody on the Russian side to talk to. Therefore, despite all these multiple violations, it's unlikely that he will not fully be not recognized as illegitimate. And unfortunately, he probably knows that as well.
Yeah, and there's no alternative like Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya in Belarus, where you can say, well, we accept her as sort of the legitimate, more legitimate president in exile.
On that note, precisely then, thank you. Transitioning to the unfortunate reality in Russia these days, Nikolai, first, I wanted to ask you about this death of Alexei Navalny, tragic death, possibly murder. We don't really know if it was direct, but it was certainly at the very least indirect, given the horrible conditions in which Navalny was held throughout these 3 years of containment in Russian prisons. Do you think that this tragic death of Navalny has anything to do with the election? Some of the arguments have been made that, as Liana pointed out, right, Putin doesn't want to have any alternative. He wants any suspicions gone. He did not allow many of the anti-war candidates to participate in this election. For example, Boris Nadezhdin, who was trying to collect signatures to run as an anti-war candidate, was not allowed to run. So maybe Navalny was deliberately killed right before the election for Putin, essentially, to eliminate any possible challenge. What is your take on this? Is there a certain timing here that suggests that might be the case?
I think it's very legitimate question, but first of all, I'd like to add whether the West will or will not recognize Putin as a legitimate leader. I do not see any reasons for the West not to recognize Putin, or at least it's possible not to recognize him rhetorically, but you should deal with him. There is no way, like in Belarus, for example, we can say that Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya was elected the president, but in order to deal with Belarus, you should communicate with Lukashenko, and this is exactly what we see. So nobody cares, I think, at the Kremlin whether the West will recognize or will not recognize elections, and it will be easy for the Kremlin if the West will not recognize results to demonstrate similar approach to American presidential elections. And we do discuss that Putin is 71-year-old authoritarian leader, but look at the United States. We do have two candidates. One of them is 81 years old, another is 77 years old. So it's very important when discussing what's going on in Russia and what Russians do think about what's going on in their country, to understand that the background is not that positive. And this is not only Ukraine with Ukrainian presidential elections, but it's the West as well. And now let me say...
Just to jump in, by the standards of U.S. politics, Putin is actually as a teenager, right?
Yes. In 10 years, he will reach present-day Biden's age. So in case of Navalny, I think that Navalny was a brilliant populist type politician, who could ruin Putin's game in these presidential elections. Well, it's understandable that he was murdered, but it's not that much, and I suppose will be not understandable, at least in a while, whether he was murdered by, well, direct present-day order, or he was murdered by the very fact he was kept in horrible conditions for 3 years after the attempt to poison him. Anyway, it's Navalny who could say and who could demonstrate that the king is naked, or in this particular case, the Tsar is naked. And Navalny was the single and unique politician, democratic politician, who could approach huge masses of Russian voters, not only those who were in favor of, liberalism and full-scale democracy. But I do think that his murder was most of all mafia-style signal to Russian elites and to the West, and it's not by chance that it has been reported the same day when Munich conference was opened. I did mention that it's very important for the Kremlin to avoid any scandals and any doubts regarding the fact that Putin is wholeheartedly supported by overwhelming majority of Russians. And there are already two things which do damage this image. One is lines to give signature in favor of Nadezhdin, who is absolutely no-name candidate, but he was the single one saying that the war should be stopped. And this is very important because those lines were shown in big cities in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and everywhere else. And the second is Navalny's funeral and the fact that crowds, tens of thousands of Russians were coming there and are still coming to bring flowers to Navalny's grave. And so it creates a very different signal from the one which the Kremlin is trying to demonstrate. And finally, Navalny's idea with regard to this election's technical voting idea was anti-Putin's move on March 17th, and he was claiming for all who do support him to come on March 17th at noon to polling stations to demonstrate how big the crowd which does oppose Putin and the war, the horrible war which has been started by the regime, to demonstrate that there are numerous opponents of the regime. And let's wait till March 17th to see whether it will happen. And if so, it will be a very strong signal as well.
Thank you, Nikolai. But just to clarify, you said that the Kremlin was trying to avoid any major, like, as you said, disturbances prior to the election. Wouldn't it then be a little bit weird to get rid of your major political opponent, arguably a little less than a month before the election, right? It would seem to be the opposite of what the expectation was, no?
Well, we can estimate the effect of any signal, including this murder, comparing costs and benefits. The cost was not that high for the Kremlin in terms of the fact that Navalny, after staying for 3 years in prison, was year by year losing his recognition level and his popularity among ordinary Russians. And the Kremlin did ruin the whole network Navalny did create at the time of previous 2018 presidential elections. But it was very important, I think, for Putin as the leader of mafia to send the signal demonstrating that those who are trying to oppose him will be punished in a very cruel way. And here, I think, his estimate was right in the sense that it sends much stronger signal to political elites than the cost taken by the Kremlin.
So it's signaling that I'm having the situation under control, so to speak.
Absolute control, yes. And it's the signal to the West as well. you should speak to me. You should not discuss any possibilities to organize exchange of prisoners and so on if Navalny is part of the deal.
Leanna, do you agree? Is that the signal that the West is getting? And with Navalny gone, are there any other perhaps opposition leaders one in the West can, you know, look at, hope for? There's still a lot of Russian wannabe opposition leaders. Let's put it this way. Navalny probably had an unchallenged claim to that status, but there are also others who still exist. Do you think perhaps the West will kind of try to refocus on hoping that these people will one day occupy a similar position, similar standing to the one of Navalny had?
Yeah, just perhaps to add a little bit to the international dimension of Navalny's death, and Nikolai already mentioned it, the signal at the Munich Security Conference, but also there were also reports, or I don't know if you can already call them reports, but rumors that the German government was in discussion about a potential exchange with Navalny against Krasikov, against the Tiergarten murderer who's held in Germany. And we know for a long time, and Putin has confirmed this already in the Tucker Carlson interview, that Russia is looking to exchange the Tiergarten murderer, for example, Ivan Gershikov, or anyone that Russia holds sort of hostage right now. And that's, it's usually, again, counterintuitive. If there were such talks, why to kill Navalny if that would have been a chance for Russia to get the Tiergarten murderer back? But it could also have been a test balloon from the Russian side to see if the German government is willing at all to discuss an exchange, because the public stance has been in the past, no, he is murdered on German soil. We will not exchange him for any other hostage. And also in the past, Russia has thought that it's enough to exert pressure on the United States to get the United States to demand from Germany to release the Tiergarten murderer. Now they might have realized that they need some more leverage against Germany itself. So that could be one theoretical explanation. I'm not saying it's the only one why, if those talks took place, Navalny was killed. And I mean, for the other opposition, I mean, the main other opposition leaders are obviously also jailed and in danger right now. So there's no one really that the West can put their money on. I think it's probably sort of what is possible is to make it as hard as it can only be for the Kremlin to get to the numbers that they want to get, right? I mean, that's the only option probably left for the Russian population who doesn't accept these elections, to invalidate their votes, to join the protest vote, to vote for any other candidate, which was also part of Navalny's strategy in the past, then Putin, and just to make sort of the resources that the Kremlin has to invest to get to those numbers higher. And in the end, that's what the West can use sort of as a measurement. How much effort has it been for the Kremlin to get to those numbers? And from that, one can derive where perhaps the real numbers would have been. But in terms of opposition, there's really not much hope for the West. Of course, there are attempts to think about how the opposition in exile can perhaps be organized, how they can be supported. But there's little political effort to endorse any of these opposition candidates who live in exile in the West, also because of disagreements between the different groups and so on. It is a campaign, it is an election, basically without an opposition, without anything that the West can place their bets on, apart from making clear that these elections are not considered fair and free.
Thank you, Leanna. Indeed, quite a gloomy landscape. I mean, it was already quite gloomy even before, certainly even worse now with Navalny gone. What, though, is the message that Putin is trying to present to the Russians in this election? Is he mentioning the war at all? And so maybe then there are some other candidates who are less straightforward on the war. So, Nikola, maybe you can comment, like, what is the message that Putin tries to, against this fairly, you know, empty landscape, to present to the Russian society? What is the role that the war is playing in it? Is Putin, like, the unifier of the Russian land, the victorious leader, or is the war sort of sidelined as opposed to other considerations? That's sort of the impression that I got from his recent federal address, in which he sort of tends to focus a lot on other issues as well. So curious as to what your take would be.
First of all, when I was saying that it's not that easy to jump higher if it's your fifth attempt, it's about the message. First of all, it's very complicated to find anything new after all these promises which Putin was giving for many years, and some of them have been realized, some were not. But what is important, first of all, I think, it's when discussing the future elections is to understand that, of course, they are not fair because Putin was choosing his competitors, but they can be more or less free. And what we see from sociological polls is the fact that Putin's popularity did increase recently up to 75%. Of course, we can discuss what sociological polls in authoritarian state are telling, but we need to compare previous results and this month results to understand that Putin's popularity did increase. And partly it's due to the fact that after the beginning of the war, all of a sudden, many Russians did feel like the threat of the large-scale world war was not realized, and their attitude to the war, and this is the way how the Kremlin presents the war in Ukraine, it's going on far away from Russia. It doesn't touch Russians. Russia is showing impressive results in economy, and at least life level is pretty high. It's not declining, unlike in many other states. Unlike the West, Russia is showing impressive economic growth. Nobody discusses what's the reason of these figures, but anyway, it's not for ordinary Russians to compare economic growth in different countries. They do compare their life level now with what it used to be a while ago. And so far, they do not feel like they are suffering a lot. They do not feel like they are involved into the war. The war is still going on somewhere far away from their homes. And finally, and this is very important, all these huge human losses, including losses of Russian soldiers, well, it's a kind of a business deal. So those soldiers were offered very generous money, or their families in case of their death. That's why the very fact of their death doesn't lead to changing public opinion with regard to the war. So we do see Putin exploiting the fact that Russia is much better now than it looked 25 years ago when he first came to power. And this is what the huge exhibition Russia is about. Second, he is demonstrating very strong paternalist approach. And many Russians are happy with the fact that they're getting more money. They are getting, well, their life level is still very high, unlike the life level in many other countries. And he's exploiting family values, which is not perhaps that impressive, but anyway, there is nothing anybody can oppose him. It's not bad to support families. It's not bad. The poverty level in Russia is now lower than it used to be. And partly it's direct result of the war, because at the time of the war, the money given to attract soldiers is sent to depressive regions, most of all, and their life level is increasing. The money to produce tanks and weapons is given to those industrial regions which used to be not in a great shape before the war, and they do enjoy this. And there is huge construction which is going on, not in Moscow and St. Petersburg as it was the case, but far away from Moscow. So Russian regions, many of them, do feel like they did benefit from the war. And this is demonstrated by the Kremlin and by Putin, and this is exploited by them.
Thank you, Nikolai. So to sum it up, the message is like reinforced resilient Russia, maybe without so much emphasis on the war as much as on the general like development that's happening, right, while Russia is resisting to all this hostility directed against it, if I'm reading this right.
Yes, right. And there is justice. And this is very important, and it's what Putin did demonstrate at the time of his State of the Union address. He did tell that those who are fighting for the country, who are fighting for us, they should become the new Russian elite. So it's very important to see Putin as a populist leader. He is staying in power for 25 years, but he still is capable to exploit anti-elite feelings.
That's ironic, and very much, if I'm allowed to make the comparison, in the very much the same way that Stalin's repressions opened up new social lifts for newcomers into the system, right? This war, somewhat kind of sadly, right, through the elimination perhaps of the so-called liberal elements from the system, or just pure through sheer losses that Russia experiences on the front line, creates these opportunities for the new elites to emerge to power, and therefore reshuffling the whole system, making it potentially more stable going forward. Liana, how do you see this dynamic? I'm also interested in the change. Do we see the change of narrative? Like Nikolai pointed out, that it's hard for Putin to come up with anything new after he's been in power for almost quarter a century. I wonder to what extent you see this shifting narrative and the message addressed to the society, in much in the same way as we see Putin essentially change his narrative towards the international community. Because when it comes to the international community, all masks are off. It's open hostility, right? Long-term, essentially Cold War, or even worse. I wonder if you see that that also the narrative gets translated in on the domestic level.
Yeah, just to underline what Nikolai has just been saying, because I think it's such an important point. The West has hoped at the beginning of the war that the body bags that will come back to Russia will to some extent lead to a reduction of support for the war, that it will be the body bags that in the end might lead Russians to come to the streets and to protest against the war and perhaps to create some pressure from below. And I think what Nikolai has just said is exactly the contrary. The body bags are actually quite lucrative, right? I mean, so there has been just this paper coming out from a researcher from the Finnish Central Bank, who also made the case that in the poorest regions in Russia, suddenly the private wealth that are sort of deposited in banks by the poorest citizens has increased. And that is exactly a result of those body bags coming home, because they get up to 5 million rubles for any deceased soldiers. So it is, the body bags are a lucrative source of income for the poorest regions. And that is so cynical, but it also contradicts directly the hopes that the West had at the beginning, which at some point might still be true, that there are too many body bags, even for the amount of money that you get. But at the moment, those are actually creating wealth in the poorest regions.
If
in
I
Russia.
Could jump in, Elena, in other words, if Afghanistan in the Soviet Union, late Soviet Union, was happening against the backdrop of not the economic crisis and decline in oil revenue, like in the oil prices, right? But instead, fairly stable or positive dynamic of the budget, we may not have seen the same impact of Afghanistan on the Soviet Union, because we tend to believe that all these dead bodies led to collapse of the system, but maybe it was ultimately the economic crisis after all.
That's a very good point. And when it comes to the sort of to the narratives that Vladimir Putin has, I mean, one change of narrative is obviously the tolerance of any kind of opposition, right? So that is perhaps the biggest change to the last elections, that the repression is just so high as it has never been, right? And even for those sort of remembering the Soviet Union. And this is certainly one part of the narrative which has changed, and where Vladimir Putin is saying, well, I mean, I'll give you money, I'll give you social welfare, but there is really no room anymore for you to oppose the regime. The spaces for that are shrinking. And I think we've seen that, and we discussed it, Maria, at the funeral and also at the mourning for Navalny after his death, that especially men tried to hide from the cameras, because there were reports that young men got immediately got imprisoned for a couple of days, but then afterwards were sent to the front in Ukraine. And I mean, that's obviously such a brutal and cruel response to just laying down flowers for Navalny, not only to get into prison for a couple of days, which probably many of those expect to turn out there, but then for the man to immediately be sent to the front, knowing what that means in all brutality and cruelty. So this kind of space for even mourning, this kind of space for opposition through mourning, this is something which definitely has changed in his narrative.
I will also add to that perhaps the civilizational discourse. Did you, Nikolai, Ulyana, see the mentioning of this particular emphasis on Russia being the unique civilization, a part of this broader presidential campaign? I know that that was something quite debated by the presidential administration. Did they follow through, or did they end up dropping this idea? Russia in the, you know, preparing the country essentially for the long-term contestation against the West, for the long-term war, presenting Russia as this last strong pole of this unique civilization that it represents. And apparently family values, Nikolai, as you pointed out, play a role in that dynamic.
I think it's exploited somehow, although we can say that there is one understandable major focus in President Putin's campaign, if we can speak about campaign. And it's important to understand that he didn't make a break in his presidential duties, and he demonstrates that his trips to regions, his promises, it's part of his usual work and nothing else. So it's not like, say, a special campaign. But the fact that there is a kind of martial law in Russia, it's easier for Putin to combine his position of the president with his position of the commander-in-chief to exploit this image of Russia fighting against the West, and it's fighting in a just war, which has been started not by Russia, but it has been started by the West. And it's the major message he sends. And unfortunately, I think that there is no way for Putin to stop the war, to be somehow interested ending the war and explaining what exactly has been achieved in result of the war and what are the real costs of the war. So that's why I think that Putin will never end the war if only it will be in his will. And of course, he can be interested in making the war less intensive, but not to stop the war, because it gives him a lot of new leverage. And this is understandable. The reason why, well, Ukraine is not eager to hear presidential elections is playing the opposite role in Russia, because it makes it easier for the Kremlin to win, to demonstrate huge victory in forthcoming elections.
And also, just to add, I mean, it's also this historic mission that is also new, right, compared to the last election. So the kind of, I mean, in the past, Vladimir Putin, I mean, was perhaps comparable to, you know, Boris Yeltsin, to other presidents of Russia, right, or leaders of Russia. But by now, he sees himself in his historic mission, his historic obsession, in line with, right, Catherine the Great, and, you know, all these, in line with Stalin to some extent, with all these huge figures. So from his perspective, with his weird historic obsession, he himself has positioned him up to the top tier of historical figures in Russian history. And that is something which obviously, to some extent, also reverberates in the population, that it's not only a Russian leader that they have to re-elect, but it's one of the historic figures of Russia's history who is trying to revise all the negative outcomes for Russia's place in the world after the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union. So he has tried to elevate himself even one step higher in the hierarchy of the history books.
So the picture essentially that we are presenting here is quite gloomy. It's a civilizational fortress, Russia, committed to long-term fight against the West, economically and on societal level, feeling quite comfortable and domestically eliminating all of the possible. How long is this going to last? Is this a sustainable situation? And is this dynamic going to stay there as long as Putin is in power, or perhaps even beyond that? Liana, we just recently published a report on the leadership change in Russia, talking about the situation not just under Putin, but also mapping certain scenarios beyond Putin. So what is your take on that? If you might perhaps sum it up, some of the key takeaways of this report, especially with this in mind, like gloomy dynamic only lasts with Putin, or shall we be preparing for potentially more dangerous, Russia as dangerous even beyond his rule?
Yeah, thank you, Maria, for this elegant link to our paper, because I do think it matters at this point. But what we try to outline in this paper is three possible scenarios that can be successor scenarios for Vladimir Putin. Even sort of, it could be a conspiracy by elites that sort of try to get rid of him, or even if he gets sick and leaves the stage, those could be potential succession scenarios. And what we have not in this paper is a scenario of westernization or liberalization. And many have asked, why is that not inside? And that's pretty easy to explain, because we saw that there's no real probability for any kind of Gorbachev type to emerge. What is more likely, what can emerge after Putin, and this paper argues, is a scenario referring to other historical figures, which is a Khrushchev scenario, with a Putinism without Putin scenario, where someone comes to power and pursues a retrenchment, who wants to get rid of the worst parts of the Putinism, but still continues the main system and keeps the main system alive, and might reach out to the West for some kind of negotiations in return for economic concessions, might try to negotiate in Ukraine, even if not withdrawing all troops entirely. That is something which, from a historical perspective, this paper argues could be likely. The other alternative could be a radicalization scenario, an Andropov type figure, where someone even more radical from the security services replaces Vladimir Putin, although on the ladder of radicalism, he's already pretty high up. So I know that this is a fear that is shared among many Western capitals, that someone even worse than Putin will come. But certainly, there's not much room for being even worse than Vladimir Putin.
Our imagination fails us, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there could be also a fragmentation scenario, which would be linked to an economic crisis, where the center would lose control of Russian regions, or alternatively, where there would be an infighting in Moscow between different elites in the security services in case an attempt at overthrowing the leader goes wrong and we end up in a fragmented power system. And apart from saying that the West should not be frightened too much by leadership change in Russia, because again, how much worse can it get than Vladimir Putin? The other point is that it needs really preparation for all these scenarios to have the kind of alliance unity that is needed to react to someone who perhaps might reach out to the West, but also preparation to prevent a situation where the West is completely inactive and is not able to respond to this kind of leadership change. And this is the argument that the paper makes. The West, the United States and Europe should not remain passive. They should convey a positive message to Russians and prepare, even if it seems unlikely right now, for leadership change in Russia to have a coordinated response, and not what we see, for example, right now when it comes to Ukraine, France and Germany sending completely different messages, the United States out of the game because they cannot bring through Ukraine support. That's exactly what Moscow likes to see and exactly a message that we would not want to send in case of a leadership change in Russia.
Many thanks, Liana. So, Nikolai, and also our audiences, as you can see, one common scenario that we do not actually consider in this paper, which was written before the tragic events of the last several weeks, is the so-called beautiful Russia of the future, the liberal democratic Russia. We wrote this even before Navalny was murdered, but that was not one of the plausible scenarios that we actually considered due to lower probability. Nikolai, I'd love to get your reaction to that. Do you think perhaps we are taking it too far in our pessimism? And also you, of course, is one of the most prominent experts on the Russian elites. To what extent, in your opinion, this is coherent with the available repertoires, options among the Russian elite groups?
First of all, thanks for your report. I do like it. My congratulations. But my vision of different scenarios for future is a little bit different. I would say that in my view, there are three basic factors which will play. The first is that nobody can replace Putin in his present day capacity. And you are right that we'll see a kind of 1953 scenario. After Stalin's death, his huge powers were shared by the group of influential persons, and the intensive fight within this group has started, and it did end with Khrushchev's coming to power. But even when winning in this group, Khrushchev was not that powerful as Stalin used to be before his death. And you are right, of course, that in any case, those elites who will come after Putin will be interested to at least make a deal with the West in order to make sanctions easier and in order to get some positive signals that they could send to the public. And this is very tricky, and it's very important to understand that not only Putin is very popular now, by all means, but he will keep being popular after his death, because Putin steals from the future, and any leader who will succeed will be considered to be much less effective, because life in Russia will not keep at the same level. The level of life will decline essentially, and Putin will be remembered as a glorious leader, perhaps the
glorious
best
golden era of Putinism. So, Nikolai, sorry to interrupt, it's not just Putin himself who has to compete against his previous results, right? It's all the future Russian presidents will also have to compete against Putin, right? Putin won and unchallenged in Russian history.
Yes, right. And it's like using time machine in order to steal from the future, in order to waste resources and not to let anybody in future to use, including Russia in general, to use these resources. But my last point is connected with the fact that we do see competition of two management models. And this is very important, regardless of the fact who will succeed Putin. It's important to understand that there are two different management models. The one constructed by Putin, which looks archaic, which looks less and less effective, especially at the time of the war. Putin doesn't have trusted persons to replace those who are dying or to replace those who are losing their positions. And we do see that for years there are some vacancies at very important top-level positions. Putin's way to deal on individual level, well, makes it very complicated to, well, fix problems in a short while. Putin hates, due to understandable reasons, any formats when influential persons, when elites can gather to discuss and to find a compromise, to find a way out, which makes his system of management less and less effective at the time of the war. And there is another system represented by Mishustin, by technocrats, which is much more effective, much more modern, which is much more oriented towards feedback, which is gathering information from the internet, from social networks, which are hated by Putin, who is too old and too archaic. And I think that the future is connected with this Mishustin type model. I am not saying that Mishustin will succeed Putin, perhaps will be somebody else, but the model represented by Mishustin is the one which is winning now. And it's very important to understand that whoever will succeed Putin, the model of management will change in a very essential way in direction of the modern Mishustin style model.
So it's more institutionalized, technocratic, Mishustin-style system against more personalistic, security service-oriented Putin-style system.
Yes, right. But to add some negative things, I would say that Russian society is in a very bad situation. The social capital accumulated in 20 years was almost lost, and will take another 20 years or so to restore it. So we should not think about beautiful Russia of future, which can, well, appear in a short while. I'm sure that sooner or later it will appear, but will take 20, 30 years or even more before we'll see it.
Unfortunately, it's about all we have time for. Perhaps, Liana, some concluding remarks on Nikolai's interesting presentation. Perhaps his analysis can somehow be fit in our scenarios, and maybe the West should encourage a particular one. I'm guessing that's not the one, not the Putin-style scenario, right?
No, I mean, I would just add from what Nikolai just said, I mean, this would add another challenge to the West, not only prepare for the type of person that is coming, but also to prepare for a new management system, as you said, Nikolai, that might be taking over and that might sort of need different ways of addressing it and dealing with it than the kind of autocratic, archaic ways, which at the moment, at least, it's pretty easy to show to the world how archaic and how 20th century, first half of 20th century Putin is, right? But a new management system, which might appear more modern, might be more difficult to counter and to challenge as Putin's system.
Fortunately, no matter which direction we look at, it seems to look fairly gloomy. And also, unfortunately, we're out of time. So we're going to have to end it there. I think we all agree that this election is important, not due to the puzzle as to who's going to win, but more because it's another indication of the change in Russia, the reshuffle of the society, of the elites, of the messaging, and this new emerging reality that unfortunately is with us there to stay, even potentially beyond just Putin alone. We all agree that whatever the scenarios are playing out in the future, it's probably not going to be the beautiful Russia of the future, the dream that Navalny have, which unfortunately is now gone with him. A massive thanks to both Nikolai and Liana for joining us again on the show. And another big thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in and listening despite the gloomy conclusions that we keep coming to. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our show and give us a positive rating if you haven't already. Additionally, be sure to check out our sister podcast, The Europhile, wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Russian Roulette. We hope you enjoyed this episode and tune in again soon.
Russian Roulette releases new episodes every 2 weeks on Thursdays and is available wherever you get your podcasts. So please subscribe and share our episodes online.
And be sure to check out all the latest analysis by the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at csis.org.